Welcome back to the 20-Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbingson. The impact of today's guest's journey and success on the European ecosystem really cannot be overstated enough. They've inspired a next generation of European entrepreneurs, and this show was a real honour for me to do, as one of those who was so inspired. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Ilkka Paananen, founder and CEO at Supercell, the makers of some of the most wildly successful games of the last decade, including Heyday, Clash of Clans, Boom Beach, and more. Prior to Tencent acquiring a majority stake in the company at a reported $10.2 billion acquisition price, Ilkka raised over $143 million for the company from Excel, Index, Atomico, IVP, LVP, Initial, and Lifeline, to name a few. Throughout his incredible leadership of Supercell, Ilkka's coined the term the least powerful CEO. I absolutely love this. It's a fascinating concept and one we really dig into in this episode. And I have to thank a huge amount of people. The schedule stay was a team effort. So a huge thanks to Matthias Ljungman, Kevin Camoli, Ken Lamb, David Gardner, and Pateri at Lifeline. I so appreciate your help with this schedule. But before we dive into the show today, I have to say I just love using AngelList fund admin platform to manage my investments. The team and the platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of incredible products there like AngelList fund admin platform, you have to check out Letter, the beautifully designed banking experience made for high net worth individuals. They always go the extra mile, providing you with more than you expect. Multiple physical cards, multiple checking accounts, seamless wires, virtual cards, and so much more. Plus, with none of the BS fees that we all hate so much but have become so used to. If all that wasn't enough though, every time you use your Letter card, they automatically give a tax deductible donation to the charity of your choice. So to experience the future of banking, head over to letter.co to find out more and join their waitlist. And finally, did you know there will be 1.4 million job openings for developers in 2020? Well, that's where my friends at Terminal come in. Terminal helps fast-growing companies build remote, high-performing tech teams by connecting you with elite global talent and owning end-to-end processes from hiring to onboarding to remote teams integration. Terminal delivers the product-building powerhouse your business needs to grow, from workspaces to community to on-the-ground support. They take the guesswork out of remote management so that you can really thrive. But don't take my word for it. Just ask high-growth businesses like Gusto, Chime, Earnin, and Hims, all trusting Terminal with their remote teams, and you can find out more today at www.terminal.io. But enough from me, so now I'm very, very excited to hand over to Ilkka Paananen, founder and CEO at Supercell.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Ilkka, it is such a joy to be doing this. I've heard so many great things from Kevin at Excel, to Ken at Initials, David at LVP. So thank you so much for joining me today, Ilkka.
Well, hey, thanks, Harry. So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And now, I would love to start today, though, and especially given the fact that it's, you know, nearly Supercell's 10th anniversary. Let's start with a little bit of founding story. How did you come to found Supercell, and what was that founding moment for you?
Sure. So, well, Supercell is not the first games company that I've founded. So me and a few others, we founded this company called Sumia already back in the year 2000. And then later on, we sold it to a company called Digital Chocolate in 2004. And Digital Chocolate was a great company that was founded by really well-known VCs like Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins. And it was also founded by a game industry legend, a guy called Trip Hawkins, who many would know as the founder of Electronic Arts and Freedio. So a true legend and a great, great person. And then, you know, this company, Digital Chocolate, it grew to like around 400 people over the time. And I worked as a president after the acquisition, actually for almost 6 years after we had been acquired. And then at Digital Chocolate, I guess the biggest learning for me during that time was that ultimately the most important thing about creating games is having a really great team. So if you have that great team, if you have also a bit of luck, then ultimately like everything else will fall in place. But if you don't have a great team, then there's just no chance that you will be successful. So, you know, over the years, and it took me many years to realize this, it became clear that, you know, ultimately creating games is all about these creative teams. But then the irony, I think, about many games companies, and, you know, ours at the time included, is that many companies are focused on actually everything else but the teams that create the actual games. So many of the, especially the bigger game companies, are very top-down management exercises creative control through different kinds of control mechanisms like processes and such. And now we can get to the point like what led to the foundation of Supercell, because one of those moments was actually seeing the original culture deck of Netflix, you know, back in the day. In that culture deck, like, they talked about culture of freedom and responsibility and how one should not focus on processes as the company grows, but just hiring better people and trusting them. And then, you know, when I got that deck and I got really inspired about it, and then myself and Mikko Kodisoja, who then eventually was one of the co-founders of Supercell, you know, Mikko and I, we started to talk about that idea of freedom and responsibility. But then, like, the difference to Netflix talked about freedom and responsibility of individual employees, like, based on our experience, like, Mikko and I, we wanted to kind of extend that idea to teams. And especially game development teams. And then we started to play around with this idea where you would give a complete freedom and responsibility to small game development teams. And we thought them almost like kind of small startup companies within the greater company. And then later on, we started to call these teams cells. And that actually is partly where the name Supercell comes from. And then, you know, fast forwarding a little bit. So in 2010, you know, we and some others, we left Digital Chocolate and then started to build a kind of new type of games company. And our kind of main goal was to create a company that would be simply the best place for the best people, would then form these best teams. And then ultimately that we thought that with these best teams, and of course coupled with some luck, then ultimately that would lead to kind of creation of great games. And that really was birth of Supercell like a bit more than 10 years ago.
I love that kind of leadership principle of kind of the ultimate responsibility given to the employee. I guess my question is, and it's actually one from David at LVP. He said before about being the least powerful CEO. And so I'm really intrigued when you think about the least powerful CEO, how do you think about that? And what does that mean in terms of how you engage with leadership?
Well, sort of a simple idea, you know, behind that phrase is that it's this idea that the more decision the team makes, then of course the less I as a CEO make. And ultimately, like, if I made no decisions, then and all the decisions would be made by the teams, then I would be sort of the world's least powerful CEO. So why do I think it's a good thing teams make most, if not all, the decisions? So there's a couple of reasons. The first one is that, you know, ultimately it's the teams who are kind of closest and the game developers who are closest to the players, to the kind of end users of the games. And they obviously know what is the best thing to do for the game and what's the best thing to do for the players. Therefore, I would argue that the decisions that these people make, they are of higher quality. They are just better decisions than those of the people at the higher level of management make. Then also, like, if you just give these teams like a complete freedom and responsibility to make these decisions and they don't need to ask for approvals from anybody else, it just means that, you know, because there's no approval loop, they can just execute faster, you know, because they don't need to ask anybody. And then thirdly, if you do kind of give that complete trust to the teams, it's just a more motivating and rewarding environment for the best creative people to work at. And, you know, and they want to work in this environment where they just completely feel that they can own what they do.
Question that I just have to ask is, like, how do you create accountability within teams when they have complete ownership? And how do you think about inserting that accountability?
Well, I think it all comes down to, like, what type of people you hire. I mean, it really comes down to that. And it's ultimately the people and their everyday actions that create this culture. But over time, if you hire the right type of people who have that accountability, have that huge sense of responsibility, over the time, it'll create that type of culture. At some point, you'll get this critical mass of people who think like that. And then you just need to kind of keep that going and you need to keep kind of nurturing that type of culture. And, you know, I've also noticed that the more kind of you trust people, I mean, people also, like, the way they can respond is that they get this huge sense of responsibility. Like, most people get it sort of almost automatically if they get this feeling that they are trusted 100%.
Can I ask, what's the most challenging thing about sustaining it? Because it seems feasible within small teams and within a small number of people, but as you scale, this is more and more complex. What's the challenging thing about retaining that core element with scale?
Well, I think it probably doesn't even come from scale. I mean, as long as you just stay laser focused on the recruiting business, bit and you stay laser focused on the culture. I think most challenging moments, at least what we've experienced, are these things when, you know, when something isn't going as you would like it to go. Like, you know, it's easy to talk about all of these wonderful things like independence and trust, like when things are going well. But, you know, but the real test of that is when things aren't going as well. And especially if things aren't going as well and then you even disagree with what the team is doing. And that's the ultimate test of, do you really trust, you know, that team? And at Supercell, we've kind of borrowed this phrase. I think it's from Amazon, where they use this phrase that you disagree and you commit, you know, meaning that, okay, I disagree with what you guys are doing, but I'm going to like do everything I can to make you guys be successful and I'm going to support that. And I think you have to go through at least a couple of like situations where, you know, this is the case, and then it hopefully becomes part of the culture.
I mean, I'm really interested on the tough times there. You know, it's easy to look at a company like Supercell and go, oh, it was all up and to the right. But, I chatted to Ken at Initial before the show and Kevin actually at Excel, and they mentioned the first three games actually not being hits and, you know, ended up having to kill them. How do you deal with those really tough times, having to kill games that you put a lot of work and love into? How do you deal with those very hard times, and how do you kind of communicate that to the team?
Well, I think the most important thing is that you just have to be like completely honest and open towards everybody. And you know, you're transparent to the board about things, and you try to like communicate as much as you can. And you especially like you communicate about the failures and just being like honest and open about it. And it's a cliche, but it's the worse the news, the quicker you should tell it to everybody. I think that's a great advice. And then like internally, you know, the same thing. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, outside looking in, like it might feel that Supercell was an instant success, but I guarantee you that in the first 2 years, it definitely didn't feel like that, because, I mean, as you said, like the first three games that we put out didn't work at all. And in those situations, you know, we were really open with everybody. Like everybody knew like how much money we had left in the bank and how much we were burning per month, and make sure that everybody knows exactly where we are. But at the same time, of course, you want to keep on reminding people about these fundamental things that, you know, we believe that will make us eventually successful. And for us, those things were, you know, just the quality of people we had, the quality of the teams, and all of those amazing games that we were working on. And of course, we were also lucky at the time that we were quite well capitalized, like at the time, you know, thanks to our Series A round that we had raised from Accel Partners at the time. So thankfully, we had quite a long runway. So we also like could afford to sort of play the long game. It's harder to play the long game if you're going to run out money like in the next few months. It's a much easier thing, of course, to do if you have a slightly longer runway.
I think what's also so interesting there is when you look at those first three games which didn't work, you then had three games which absolutely knocked it out of the park, which you and I both know is very, very rare to have three hits in a row continuously. The question I have there is, like, you then have very confident teams. How do you think about ensuring there's a sense of realism and teams don't get overconfident because they've suddenly had three wins on trot?
Well, that's a great question, you know, and it, ironically, like, I think at least in our industry, in the games industry, like, the more successful you are, the harder it becomes to create the next hit game, I feel. Because, you know, when you kind of start and there are no expectations, and you kind of have nothing to lose. There's like no pressure as such. So it's easier to just, you know, follow your instincts and just, you know, create the game and ship it and see how it works. And that's certainly what we did like very early on. And in a way, I'd like us to still operate that way. So I'll not think about like, you know, past or a future too much, but, you know, focus on the present and try to build the best possible game and act on our instincts and put it out and see how it works. And, you know, sometimes it works and then and oftentimes it doesn't. But, you know, like, as I said, you know, it becomes maybe slightly harder when you have these like mega hits like on your belt. And you know, games industry, it's such a like competitive industry. It's, our industry is filled like so many fantastic teams and smart peoples. And, you know, I feel that I think is actually helpful, because I think at least in our company, you know, there's a very strong awareness of that fact. And we understand very well that in our industry, the minute you think that you kind of know it all, that's going to be the end of it. Because, you know, there's hundreds and there are probably thousands of great games companies like all over the planet, and everybody wants to create the next big hit game. So you just gotta stay humble and stay very, very focused. And if you don't, you know, it won't end well.
I'm really pleased you mentioned competition there, because I spoke to Matthias and Ken at Initial before the show, and they said how kind of incredibly competitive you are, but also how humble you are. And a question that I always think is like, should you, when it comes to competition, be very aware of your competition, constantly monitor them, or should you focus on your own game, forget everyone else, and just keep your head down? What do you think is the right way to approach approach competition?
Well, it's a good question because like I as a person, I'm quite competitive. I admit that. But like think about competition from Supercell's point of view. Like I try to like not to focus on competition too much. And you know, the reason is that I believe that if you follow competition, the risk is that you may become like overly reactive, like what happens around you. And essentially the best you can be is just to be a fast follower. But if you're a fast follower, then by definition, you will always follow somebody else. You will never, ever lead. And, you know, that's my big concern about like being overly focused on competition. So, of course, we want to stay humble. And of course, we want to keep our eyes open and play games from everybody else and all that. But at the same time, I think it's even more important to just stay focused on what we believe are the games we want to build and, you know, staying kind of true to our vision and, you know, the way we do things.
In terms of like staying true to your vision, again, I spoke to Matthias and he said the really special thing with Ilkay is he's one of the most focused leaders I've ever worked with. And so when it comes to focus, you know, you could have spread like crazy, especially in terms of geographies, and you pause in terms of kind of expansion to China. And so I'd love to hear, what do you think allows you to be so focused and how do you think about keeping the core the core?
Well, I have to say that, you know, staying focused, it's definitely not something that comes naturally from me. It's something that I have had to learn from the others. And there's been a couple of guys, especially at Supercell, who've been like just amazing at being able to focus on the most important things. And, you know, and they've been really inspiring to me. And, you know, I've tried my best to learn from those people. And I think the key is that you just try to keep in mind like what is kind of the most important thing. And oftentimes what that means is that, you know, focus is not saying like what you do. It's saying no to all of those 10 things that are of interest to you and what you would love to do, like in addition to whatever thing you're doing right now. And you know, like, and for like really like say optimistic and people who get excited about all kinds of things, many entrepreneurs like myself are like, you know, that's a hard thing to do. It's just hard to say no to stuff. But I've just over the years I've learned the hard way that that's probably one of the most important things and skills you need to learn. You know, just say no and try to like keep yourself and your company focused on just, you know, one thing. Because, I mean, if you can spread your thinking and resources and efforts too thin, then you can't really be great at anything. And I know it's such a competitive world that you just have to be, like, super focused on one thing. And then if you are, then you have a chance to, like, be the world's best at that one thing.
Can I ask, and I hope it's okay off schedule, but, like, when you think about kind of the optimism and you're an incredibly optimistic person, when you think about risk, how do you evaluate and think about your own relationship to risk?
Well, how I think about it is I think like in my opinion, like companies, I don't think they ultimately fail because they take risks. I think fail because they stop taking risks. And, you know, therefore, I think it's extremely important for, you know, companies to have this culture which actually encourages risk taking. And the most important part of encouraging risk taking, I think, is how the company deals with failure. And you have to make it like completely safe to fail in the company. Because if you think about it, like if a company like never ever fails, essentially means that they probably aren't trying to do a kind of hard enough thing, or the bar just isn't like high enough. And that they're not trying to, like, you know, innovate. And all of those things would be really, really scary. So I think failure actually is a really good thing. I mean, if I one day I would wake up and realize that, oh, you know, we actually haven't failed, like, not once in the last year, that would be a really scary moment for me, because that would lead me to believe that we aren't taking enough risk. And if we aren't taking enough risk, I don't think we can create the next big hit game either.
How do you make failure an accepted part of development within the company? Is it just through saying, hey, it's okay to fail, you're not going to be punished? How does one engender that in the culture?
Well, you know, we've tried all kinds of like hilarious things, I think, to make it as safe as possible. It all started when we kind of killed our first game. I think it was back in 2011. And I still remember it was this lunch table conversation. And the lead of that game that was just killed, like, say that, hey, I want to get the company together and I want to do this kind of post-mortem session. And I want to explain everybody like what we learned through this failure. And I want to explain like what happened. And then I thought to myself over at lunch hour, that, oh, it's going to be a bit of a sad company meeting. I need to do something to cheer it up. And of course, we were a lot smaller about those days, maybe like 30 people or so. And then just, you know, I got this idea that, hey, you know, I'm going to make it a bit of more funnier meeting. I'm going to go and just buy a bottle of champagne for everybody in the team. And then that's what I did. And just crossed my mind. And over lunch hour, went to the shop and bought a couple of bottles of champagne and handed them over to the guys, like, because they had failed, sort of to celebrate the failure. And I think everybody sort of thought it was quite funny. And then that actually became a tradition in the company, which we sort of still have. So whenever we kind of like fail, we actually do celebrate, like, not the failure itself, because failing isn't cool or fun. Everybody knows it sucks. But, and we are not celebrating the failure. We are celebrating the learnings that comes from that failure. So, you know, and you know, ultimately, like, how you create a culture where it's safe to fail. Well, I mean, you just need to fail many, many times, and then you have to be open about it. And then over time, people, you know, start to realize that, hey, you know, failing, it's not the worst thing in the world. And, you know, nobody got punished. Actually, like, we got these valuable learnings. And if that has happened, like, and the more that happens, the easier it becomes.
Yeah, no, I agree with you in terms of that kind of becoming slightly easier. Can I ask, one thing that I personally really struggle with is, like, being disliked. I end up saying yes to far too many things because I'm afraid of being disliked in any respect. As a leader, how do you think about kind of getting comfortable with sometimes being disliked and not everyone approving or agreeing or liking your decision?
I think a lot of us are like you in that sense. And maybe it's something that comes from a couple of things. So of course it comes from experience. I mean, if you like truly believe in what you're doing, then ultimately like you just have to like follow your instincts. And there really is like no other way. And you know, that's what I always tell to, like, say, you know, up and coming entrepreneurs or people who, you know, maybe I'm an investor to their company these days. I always tell them that one of my biggest advices to founders is that, you know, listen to everybody, try to get the feedback, but then ultimately you have to be the one who decides. I mean, it's your company and no one knows better than you what's the right thing to do for the company. And just, you know, follow what your gut tells you to do. And, you know, sometimes it leads to situation where you can't please everybody, and that's fine. And again, I think it's something that, you know, comes from those type of experiences.
Can I ask another slightly personal one, but I'm too intrigued. You know, your humility is something that shone through in everyone I spoke to, and, you know, very evident. And despite the incredible success with Superstar, it's like, how do you think about kind of ego within leadership and bluntly ensuring you retain that humility as you have done with the scaling of companies, revenues, and, you know, the success that comes with it?
Well, I guess I'm lucky in a sense that I get to work like with people who are extremely humble, and you know, that's of course inspiring, and that sort of spreads. And then I also get to, as I said, I get to work in an industry which is like full of those type of people and which is like hyper competitive, and there really like aren't like almost any entry barriers to games. I mean, it's pretty easy to sort of like, at least in theory, to kind of get in and create a game. And you just like have this feeling that you know, you just can't afford to have an ego. All you can do is to kind of stay humble, because again, like if you start to get like too full of yourself, that won't lead to anything good, and not in our industry, and I don't think in life in general.
I do want to touch on one final thing before the quickfire, and it's when it comes to kind of, we mentioned success there, and you've been very public before in terms of kind of, you know, tax returns and kind of been very generous philanthropically. I'd love to hear, how do you think about your relationship to money, and how has that changed over time?
Well, I think the one thing that has changed from a times when I, you know, had absolutely no money is this huge feeling of responsibility. So, you know, I feel that I've been like very, very, very lucky in my life. I've got to work with some really amazing, talented people and the teams, and who've created these great games. And of course, they've been also financially very successful. And that also has made me in turn successful. And now I feel that the overarching feeling that I have is that I think that I have this very big responsibility to use kind of all of this kind of wealth in the best possible way and actually like do something good with it, because I've been so lucky in my life. So it really like brings this very big sense of responsibility.
Can I ask, do you feel the weight of responsibility? It may not be financially in terms of philanthropically, but just, you know, leading Supercell and leading a huge team and incredible people, there's a lot of responsibility. I struggle with the weight of responsibility, bluntly. How do you think about the weight of responsibility and how you deal with it?
As I said, like huge amount of responsibility in many different ways. And of course, I care so much about the people that we have at the company. You know, I'm really, really thankful, and I care about all these hundreds of millions of people who play our games. And as I said, there's, of course, like being also financially successful as a company and as a person, of course, that also brings a lot of responsibility. And I, you know, of course, you think about it. And I think you have to like think that, okay, like with all of these things that I'm so lucky to have, like, how do I like turn them into something good, and how could it like benefit, like, you know, know, not just me or not just our company, but the other people around me. And, you know, that really is the best feeling, that when you get this feeling that you've been able to contribute to people around you and to the community around you.
I do want to move into my favorite though, which is a quick fire round, Ilkka. So I say a short statement and then you give me your immediate thoughts. Are you ready?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so what's your favorite book and why?
Well, one thing that I'm very passionate about is company cultures, and the best, by far the best book I've read on the topic is by Ben Horowitz, called What You Do Is Who You Are.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. It's one of my favorites as well. Tell me, what's the hardest element of your role with Supercell today?
Well, you know, one thing that I think about every single day is that how can I help our teams to make an impact? And, you know, what can I do to make the Supercell a better place for our teams and for our people? What can I do to make the teams better?
How did you respond to your greatest failure?
Well, you know, I don't actually think about these events that you're referring to as failures anymore. I used to do that. But these days, how I think about them, I think them as like kind of sets of experiments. Like whatever I do, I try to think it as an experiment. And some of these experiments work and many of them don't. But, you know, no matter what happens, I will learn. And that's how I think about those.
Yeah, no, I think it was Nelson Mandela that said there's no such thing as losing. There's winning and learning. So totally with you there. Tell me, what three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
I'd like my children to be humble. I'd like them to be very curious and open-minded about the world and the people around them. And then just I want them fundamentally to be like nice people.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on those three. Which leader do you most look up to and why?
Well, as I said, I've been very lucky in my life that I've gotten to work with like so many amazing people. And the leaders that I probably most look up to these days, I mean, they're all at Supercell, because of course I get the chance to work with them with every day, and many of their, they don't have even the lead as a title, but they are just leaders or drivers, like, you know, as people. And you know, these people who, you know, just do amazing things, like, you know, very proactively on their own, always thinking about like the Supercell first, and you know, putting their own interest aside and thinking about others, and you know, making sacrifices for the team's sake and for the company's sake. And there are so many leaders like that at Supercell. So I look up to them.
And then the final one, and probably the most important, what do the next 5 years hold for you and for Supercell? Paint that picture for us, Ilkka.
Well, I think we sort of returned to the founding idea. So we wanted Supercell to be the best place to create the best games. And, you know, I want to help our people to make Supercell an even better place for the best people and for the best teams to create the best possible games.
Listen, as I said before the show, I heard so many wonderful things from so many of your board, from so many of the investors. This has been so much fun to do. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Harry. I really enjoyed it.
I mean, wow, I just loved having Ilkka on the show there, and just the epitome of authenticity and kindness, and such exciting times ahead for Supercell. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. However, before we leave you today, I have to say I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team and the platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of incredible products there, like AngelList Fund Admin Platform, you have to check out Letter, the beautifully designed banking experience made for high net worth individuals. They always go the extra mile, providing you with more than you expect. Multiple physical cards, multiple checking accounts, seamless wires, virtual cards, and so much more. Plus, with none of the BS fees that we all hate so much but have become so used to. If all that wasn't enough though, every time you use your Letter card, they automatically give a tax-deductible donation to the charity of your choice. So to experience the future of banking, head over to letter.co to find out more and join their waitlist. And finally, did you know there will be 1.4 million job openings for developers in 2020? Well, that's where my friends at Terminal come in. Terminal helps fast-growing companies build remote, high-performing tech teams by connecting you with elite global global talent and owning end-to-end processes from hiring to onboarding to remote teams integration. Terminal delivers the product building powerhouse your business needs to grow. From workspaces to community to on-the-ground support, they take the guesswork out of remote management so that you can really thrive. But don't take my word for it. Just ask high-growth businesses like Gusto, Chime, Earnin, and Hims, all trusting Terminal with their remote teams, and you can find out more today at www.terminal.io.
As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you a phenomenal episode on Thursday.